This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Little robots that roam your body eating cancer or fat cells? It could happen. I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Today on the show, some science that sounds more like science fiction. When Lance Armstrong won his seventh consecutive Tour de France last Sunday, he was called a freak of nature, able to use oxygen more efficiently than any human being on the planet. Well, geneticists, neuroscientists, and all kinds of specialists are working on innovations that could make any one of us into a Lance Armstrong. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. On Reporter's Notebook later on, Senator Bill Frist changes his stance and will now support the stem cell bill when it comes to the Senate vote. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. From robots that will enter our bloodstream to devour cancer cells to near-infrared wavelengths that will heal a wounded soldier's tissue right on the battlefield to a pill that could improve a kid's SAT score by 200 points, we're on the verge of some radical medical and scientific transformations. What it means to be human is about to evolve in ways unimaginable to us in 2005. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, Senate Republican leader Bill Frist this morning switched his stand and will now support federal funding of stem cell research. But first, this news today. There's been a flurry of activity in both London and Rome today, arrests being made of men evidently connected to the failed July 21st attacks on London's transportation system. Here joining us now is Sebastian Rotella, who's the Paris bureau chief for the LA Times, currently covering the bombings in London. Mr. Rotella, thanks for giving us some time.
Thanks, Diana. My pleasure.
Okay, first of all, give us the scene, because the images we're getting back here, I said a flurry. It just seems that there's some great heart taken by the public in London that some real concrete moves have been made by the police in their operations.
I think people feel a lot safer today because all three bombers have been arrested, two of them here. After brief confrontations, it was a standoff here for a while, but it all seems to have ended peacefully with two of the bombers arrested here and a third who had run as far as Rome, where he had family, and was tracked by cell phone communications as he came through France and northern Italy, was also arrested today in Rome. So all three are now in custody.
Is it your understanding that the gentleman arrested in Rome probably left London very, very quickly, very shortly after the July 21st incident, given that his images were up on certain television screens?
Well, everybody's image was up on television screens. The other three stayed in Britain, but I think he did leave. It sounds to me, it's still coming together, that he had been out of the country for at least several days, if not longer. But for whatever reason, while the others, one of them ran to Birmingham, the other two were right here in London. But he, I think, taking advantage of having a family, I believe a brother in Rome, made his way that far, but he was tracked through police cooperation with the French and the Italians in particular.
Yes, there seems to be a tremendous fraternity of cooperation at this point with authorities all across the world.
There is, and in Europe in particular, though sometimes it doesn't work as well as it should and there are conflicts, it's remarkable to see in cases like this, which I've been covering for the past couple of years, where there's a real need for sort of real-time cooperation with people going back and forth across all these borders, how fast and how officially it can work with two or three countries involved. There are moments of conflict, but today was a perfect example of how the cooperation can work.
Yes. What do we know about these men at this point?
Well, I think they all fit the same profile. The three we know about are the one in Rome is of Ethiopian descent, but naturalized British citizen. Another is Eritrean, but also British. They all seem to have come as children or teenagers from East Africa, and really been raised and radicalized here, I think. So they're radicalized in a scene that we're already familiar with in London, sort of where there's a real mix of nationalities, but where particularly Afro-British young men have been radicalized at a couple of mosques and some of them in prison. Circles similar to those that produced the shoe bomber, Richard Reed, if you remember.
Yes, of course. Do we make assumptions then that the terrorist threat is obviously much bigger than Al-Qaeda?
Well, I don't know if it's much bigger than Al-Qaeda, but I mean, Al-Qaeda is shorthand for talking about this constantly evolving multi-ethnic set of loose alliances that, where it's hard to tell how much is just sort of convergences of people who are inspired by the same things and to which sense they're operational. I mean, one of the great questions is going to be to see the extent to which these guys and their attempted attack are connected to the previous one on July 7th by a group with a different profile who were from Leeds, if you remember, mostly British Pakistanis. Every indication is that they are, but and it seems that there is ultimately an international network or international operatives connected in some way to Al-Qaeda involved. But it remains to be seen, and there's a real jigsaw puzzle still to put together here.
Yes, and it was part of solving today's puzzle, the fact that they had already arrested 24 or so people, and over this last week, they, through those interrogations, led them to the arrest today?
That was part of it, and also I think they had a certain amount of physical evidence, and they had cell phone evidence, and they had a lot of different intelligence they were working with. But yeah, I mean, this is an incredible manhunt. I mean, in Britain, I don't know when the last time Britain has seen anything like this, and the rest of Europe too, because everyone is so concerned about either this network or others inspired by it trying to do the same thing.
Yes, well, it was quite dramatic. Last question, I think we all only have time for. Is this now all four from the attempted attacks last week?
All four we know about, yes. All four people whose pictures we've seen all over that we know about have been arrested. We still have to find out about if there was a bomb maker, if there was a mastermind, if there was some talk, because a fifth explosive device was found discarded on that day, if there might have been a fifth suspect involved. But the four we know about are all behind bars today.
All right. Thank you so much for all your information, Sebastian Rotella.
My pleasure. Thank you.
He's the Paris bureau chief for the LA Times, now working out of London these couple of days. I'll be back in just a moment with To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point. We're delving into the future of the human being on the show today, not politically nor sociologically, but physically. If we have evolved over the millennia according to the survival of the fittest, we have now reached an era where we are going to dictate and manipulate our evolution. Scientists are working on a way to make even acute pain disappear within 10 seconds, and an exoskeleton that can allow the wearer to lift 180 pounds as if it were 4 pounds, and a tiny swimming robot that will navigate through your bloodstream and do the work of clearing your arteries. Instead of a brave new world, we're right around the corner from a wild new world. The innovations sound like fiction, but we have scientists and futurists and reporters on the show today to tell us just how real these crazy-sounding concepts are. And first today, we're joined by Joel Garreau, who's the author of a book called Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. Mr. Garreau, also a staff writer at the Washington Post. Thank you for being here, Mr. Garreau.
Thank you, Diana.
Well, you know, I just threw out a couple of the examples that made my head dance like sugar plum fairies as I was reading about this stuff. Give us an idea of the broader picture. What sorts of areas are we now delving into, and how far are we away from reality?
Well, Diana, did you know that the military is working on making every soldier into a Lance Armstrong? This is not science fiction. It's the story of human enhancement right now. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, it's the research arm of the Pentagon.
Yes.
They have a program called Metabolic Dominance, and it's tinkering with the machinery of every human cell. The guy who used to run it told me, "We want every fighter to look like Lance Armstrong with strength and endurance that just doesn't quit. The Energizer Bunny in Fatigues kind of does it, just keeps going and going." He's talking about having people be able to stay awake for a week, go without food for a week, walk forever with a 150-pound pack. And this is the forefront of human enhancement.
Now, wait, I have to stop you right there because you bring up Lance Armstrong, and we're really not doing a sports show today, but, you know, coming from the world of sports, I'm sure you know, and I can guarantee you, as soon as any athlete, you know, who especially at an elite level already but just couldn't beat Lance,
right,
is thinking right now, are you kidding? This is on the forefront. Where do I go? How much do I pay? Let me volunteer.
Well, I know. At the University of Pennsylvania, there are researchers who have created what they call Schwarzenegger mice. And you ought to see these mice. It involves gene doping as the technology.
What do they look like?
They look, their necks are wider than their heads, and their hindquarters look like steers. And there isn't a day that goes by that these researchers don't get a call from some athlete who is volunteering because he wants to be the person to try it first as a human. And these researchers at Penn think that the 2004 Olympics were the last ones that would not have genetically modified human beings in them.
You know, we're so stuck on doping, you know, and for good reasons. You know, all of sports talks about chemical engineering, but, you know, that's just kids' play compared to this genetic engineering, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's so primitive. But what the difference is now is that we're at a turning point in history. For millennia, our technologies have been aimed outward at modifying our environment in the fashion of, you know, fire, clothes, agriculture, cities, space travel. Now, for the first time, they're increasingly aimed inward at modifying our minds, our memories, our metabolisms, our personalities, and our kids. And this is not some science fiction future. These innovations are in the labs right now and are about to hit the market on our watch. They're opening up brand new vistas, especially in what I call the GRIN technologies, which stands for genetics, robotics, information, and nanotech.
Well, take us like a, maybe if you could, just for now, a cursory sentence at a time on each one of those. Let's start with nanotechnology. What's that mean?
Nanotechnology is the process of building anything you want from the very, very small parts. I mean atoms and molecules at a time. This is expected to be a $1 trillion industry by 2015, which is roughly the GNP of Canada right now. And what this has an enormous implications because, for example, for humans, it means that you could create robots much smaller than a human blood cell that could go through your veins and by the millions and eat up fat cells or cancer cells or anything else. And it holds out the possibility of allowing people to live for a very long time with great vitality.
Incredible. Now let's go. We'll come back to everything, but go to information. Does this have to do with Moore's law and the numbers of what we can crunch on a computer today?
Yeah. What's really driving this change? The reason our lives today are so dramatically different from our parents is that we're seeing repeated doublings of innovation every 12 and 18 months. Now, a doubling is an amazing thing. It means that every increase is as tall as all of the other increases put together. So now we've had 30 doublings of computer power for a dollar since the chip was originally created in 1959. That's an increase of over 400 million times. And it's allowed us to open brand new vistas, things like into genetics, for example, understanding the most basic aspects of how our bodies work, and robotics, which means that you can begin to start thinking about connecting your mind directly to machines and vice versa, blurring the distinction between the made and the born.
And that's already being done, isn't it? There are people who have attachments literally to the brain, and without moving, without being able to move, their limbs can move them to
a
degree.
You're thinking of Matthew Nagel, for
example,
up in Boston. Last summer, he was the first human being to send an email with his thoughts, and he's also working now on controlling a robotic arm with his thoughts. One of the most amazing things that I ran into at DARPA was Belle, the telekinetic monkey. She's a cute little monkey at Duke, and she can move objects long distance with her thoughts. The way you do this, basically, is first you get the monkey hooked on a computer game where she's got a joystick, and if she hits the flashing light with her cursor, she gets a drop of juice. But she's a smart little monkey, so it's pretty clear real soon that she doesn't care about the juice. She really loves the game.
Well, I tell you, you are talking some wild stuff, and as you say, it's not just 20, 30 years from now. It's right around
it's
the corner.
Right now.
Will you stay with us, Mr. Garreau?
I'd be delighted.
Okay. I want to go to Michael Goldblatt now, because Mr. Garreau has brought up the Defense Department and DARPA, and now this, you know, the idea of controlling technology with thoughts alone, not even touching. And Mr. Goldblatt knows whereof he speaks in this area, former director of the Defense Sciences Offices at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. That's called DARPA. It's a high-tech research development branch of the Pentagon, also chairman and CEO of Functional Genetics. It's a company developing gene-targeting drugs for major human diseases. Mr. Goldblatt, thank you for being here.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let's start with this monkey that Mr. Garreau's talking about and the whole process of thought as power. Where are we in this? It sounds like we're someplace concrete already.
Well, it's certainly well advanced in the laboratory. Moving it out from the laboratory to people is always a bit of a challenge. But the thought, I think the underlying impetus here is that it's been established for decades now that one can, by tapping into the muscles, the efferent side of the brain, begin to understand what somebody wants to control, and then you can mimic that with prosthesis and other kinds of devices. And the real challenge is, can you intercept not at the efferent level of where, you know, the nerve is already pulsating for a muscle to activate, but instead go into the brain and capture the thought and decode what the brain would have decoded along the way and capture that thought and begin to activate there. And that is, frankly, a challenge which is requires the integration now, just not biology, but of material science, so you get long-living electrodes that can live in a compatible way with the brain and not be rejected by the biological systems, that you have the information computing processing power to begin to intercept and understand the signaling that is in communications which are going on within the nerve cells of the brain, and then begin to transmit that and execute a concept and thought based upon the thought process as opposed to the interpretation the brain gives on the efferent side of the muscle process. And that really requires now the part that Joel was alluding to, is the integration of multiple disciplines of science and technology and fusing them in a level which has not been what the communities have been about before. And so that's really the catalyst here, is to begin to bring these communities together and fuse the powers that each one of them have in new capabilities.
You know, the first thing that springs to mind, besides the fascination of the process you're talking about, is that, you know, we all know, we read every day that, you know, scientists are developing drugs at pharmaceutical companies and neuroscience labs, but it's frustrating because they may have something, you know, quite proven in their world, but then that next process, the financial, the political, the competitive process of getting onto shelves that we can actually use is enormous. It takes decades sometimes. So when you add in these multiple sciences and the complexity of it, as you say, we're having some success in the lab now with these, you know, the power of thought process. But really, how long will that take to get out there so that, you know, someone, and I understand your daughter is a particular personal case who could be very well served by something like this.
That's absolutely true in all accounts. I think the issue is there are a number of issues. One is safety, and safety has to be approved. Efficacy has to be proved. But there's also what's happening here is fundamentally a paradigm shift. And when you begin to challenge the status quo and look at things differently, then you have the inherent barrier of overcoming the preconceived notions that people already have. And that's probably one of the biggest challenges. And the other challenge is frankly that a lot of these technologies are come out of the imaginations of investigators, and then there is the transition between when you have an organization that's willing to underwrite the basic research to executing it into the field. And right now the world of venture capital is being much more conservative. And so if it's not a near-term opportunity, the opportunity for these ideas to get the critical mass of funding necessary to overcome these decades of these barriers that, which are putting forth in terms of development and demonstrations of efficacy, become higher hurdles.
Sure, big hurdles. Well, I tell you what, let me turn to somebody who's right in the trenches and going over some of these hurdles right now, Dr. Harry Whelan, who's a professor of neurology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Whelan has been appointed by the U.S. Department of Defense to serve as a distinguished research professor in biotechnology defense policy at both the National Defense University Center for Technology and the National Security Policy in Washington, D.C. Dr. Whelan, thanks for being here.
Hi, Diana.
Well, let's talk about, you know, I don't think you were on the line earlier when Joel Garreau was telling us that the military, Department of Defense, DARPA, is working on, you know, mice, just superhuman bodies. He makes them sound like linebackers for the Washington Redskins. And, you know, specifically, what are you working on for the military with your infrared light stuff?
Well, we're using technology based on energy in the form of light to try to increase the energy metabolism in cells so that they can recover from battlefield injuries. One of the biggest examples currently funded for us to work on for DARPA in the office that Michael Goldblatt has headed in the Defense Science Office of DARPA has been the use of light at a low intensity, but the right wavelength to be absorbed by the energy compartments of every cell, and increase the energy for healing by using this light to promote the energy drivetrain in every cell, which is called the mitochondria. And the light is in the absorption wavelength spectrum of cytochromes, which is Greek for cell color. And then this light increases cell energy after an injury, as in the case of a laser eye injury, for instance, which can occur in the military setting, and now you've probably heard some civilian pilots have been lased.
Yes.
And we've been able to show in our animal studies recovery of vision after using the low energy from light-emitting diodes at the correct wavelengths to power the energy processes of the retinal cells.
So are we talking about something so dramatic as a soldier being injured at the front line and using this technology right there, or is this, you know, really immediate?
Yes. The idea is, you know, maybe people don't all think about retinal eye injuries from lasers, but people often can think about such things as strokes. And a stroke in the brain is basically a sudden loss of blood supply to part of the brain. And there's an area which is hopelessly damaged, but then around that is an area which is getting a little bit of blood flow from other areas and might live or die depending on if you do things right away before it's hopelessly too late. Well, the same kind of thing occurs in the eye, and those golden periods before it's too late are the periods where it makes all the difference in the case of, for instance, a laser military eye injury to prevent total blindness from the areas that could go either way. So the DARPA program, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which Michael Goldblatt led the Defense Science Office
mm-hmm.
of, they have a soldier self-care program where a number of paradigm shift technologies are now being made available or being developed to be made available to soldiers for self-treatment when there are no doctors, when you're in small special operations, fast-moving forces. And if you even have a medic, he might be the first casualty.
Sure. And I understand there's a tremendous innovation now in pain research as well, delivering pain relief within 10 seconds that would last for 30 days. This would be important in the military, obviously.
Yes, some of this research has also been done in the DARPA Soldier Self-Care Program. Actually, pain vaccines are being studied by some of the other scientists in our program that use antibodies to some of the molecules that transmit the intense, excruciating, debilitating pain so that soldiers can treat themselves to counteract the debilitating part of the pain without losing the part that simply informs you to protect an injured area and without the sedation of morphine.
All right. Dr. Whelan, thank you for all that. And our guests are with us. We have another guest joining us as well. We want to certainly get into next where all these, you know, fantastic sort of ideas are going to help people who are ill with Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, all kinds of things. We'll be back in a minute with more of To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're discussing some imminent innovations that are going to soon radically redefine what it is to be a human being. Speaking now with Dr. Harry Whelan, who's a professor of neurology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Whelan, now you're describing a number of things for the Department of Defense. So a soldier could actually carry, you know, not just pain relief, but you know, all kinds of new technologies to relieve pain, to help a wound heal very quickly, right on the spot at the front lines. But take us beyond that and where all these applications, you know, might be used elsewhere in our society.
That's a good question. Certainly, we develop new self-care technologies for soldiers. They could be applied to civilian medical problems as well. For instance, if we're able to reverse blindness due to military laser eye injuries in the battlefield, certainly we could consider using those same technologies to reverse blindness in civilian medical populations, such as diabetic retinopathy, acute glaucoma, age-related macular degeneration. And we're looking at some other non-visual neurologic diseases, such as Parkinson's disease, and even spinal cord regeneration has been studied by some of our collaborators in the Defense Department. So there's a whole host of problems that may be amenable to this new technology, which instead of being a combination of drugs or surgery as in traditional medicine, is actually a way of using energy metabolism to increase the normal biochemistry of the cell's own processes for healing.
All right, Dr. Whelan, we thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We're going back to Joel Garreau now, who's the author of Radical Evolution. It's a book, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. Mr. Garreau, you started telling us about nanotechnology early in the show, and, you know, I just have this image. When I read about these little swimming robots that could go in and clear out your arteries so that you'll never have to have, heart surgery, is this already successful in the laboratory?
The robots are still are a thought experiment. They don't exist.
Okay.
But what does exist is hundreds of pounds of these nano products, which for example, there is a nano products that are 60 times stronger than steel. They're the weight of plastic. They have the perfect electrical conductivity of diamond, and they have the molecular accuracy of DNA. And this exists right now. This promises to change everything from the energy crisis to warfare. And the point is that these technologies are doubling again and again and again, which is why it's changing our lives. But the gee whiz gizmos is not really what interests me all that much. What I'm interested in is, what does this all do to the future of what it means to be human? What does this mean to relationships and loves and lives as we enter a period of engineered evolution that we create and adopt ourselves? I mean, suppose in a few years your kid comes home from school again in tears. He's saying that once again he can't compete with the kids who are brighter and better behaved and more athletic and more beautiful. And it's because their parents have bought them technological enhancements and you haven't. Well, you know, what do you do? You could say, well, that's okay, dear. We don't care what other parents do with their children's minds and bodies. We love you just the way you are. Or you could remortgage the house again to try to allow your kid to keep up with these human enhancement technologies that we've been talking about that are coming onto the market so fast. Or you could try to get the enhanced kids thrown out of your school, widening the gap that already separates enhanced humans from the naturals who could adopt these technologies but choose not to. I mean, we were talking about sports and Barry Bonds. I mean, how primitive is that? Steroids. And yet, should Barry go around with an asterisk on his forehead for the rest of his life? Because he's not really the same kind of human as the people whose records he broke. And it's this kind of change that we're going to be seeing increasingly in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, well, I find it fascinating. I see one of the terms for what we're talking about today, the future evolution, that, which is at our hands now,
right,
called transhumanism. So just in that word, transhumanism, we are moving into a different era. And if you use the simplest example of sports, as you and I have done a couple of times today, I mean, what's going to happen when an Olympic athlete who has been totally genetically modified and, been able to buy, strength and power and endurance gets up on the Olympic stand? What will distinguish humans by their will anymore if we go down this road?
Well, that could happen as soon as the 2008 Olympics. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see who walks out on those platforms and what kind of records that they create. I mean, in Radical Evolution, I say there are three scenarios about how this could work out for us humans. Some researchers think that this is like heaven, that all of these changes will mean that we'll conquer pain, suffering, stupidity, ignorance, ugliness, and even death.
We're creating utopia, really.
That's what they think. That's one scenario, and it's a credible one. I mean, it's hard to turn on the television news without hearing somebody say, in a development that seems like science fiction becoming real, and then it's another amazing change. Well, so the heaven scenario is very plausible, but it could also be the other way around. The hell scenario is equally plausible, and that's when you start handing out the sort of advances in these grin technologies that we're seeing, in which any smart graduate student with a well-equipped lab could start making these kind of changes, then some people think that you could imagine destroying the entire human race within 25 years. I mean, there was the Australian mousepox incident. In Australia, they were trying to create an alternative to some way to control mice, and they changed one genetic marker in mousepox, which is a disease that attacks mice, and they created a monster. Every one of the mice died, every single one, and then they put their results on the internet where everybody could see it. And the significance is not that mousepox hurts humans, because it doesn't, but it's a close relative to smallpox, which does. And this just drives some people nuts. They think, if you put out that kind of information about potentially how to, you know, make smallpox 100% fatal, how could you possibly avoid disaster? That's the hell scenario. But I'm pulling for the third scenario, which is prevail.
Prevail. But you're bringing up, you know, a great point, is that we could go toward miracles, and I'm sure we are. We've already seen some, and we could go toward tragedies. Let me bring in Dr. Gregory Stock now to join the program. He's the director of the Program on Medicine, Technology, and Society at the UCLA School of Medicine, author of Redesigning Humans, Our Inevitable Genetic Future. Dr. Stock, welcome.
Well, it's good to be here, Diana.
There's so many big hosts of topics swirling around today, but let's talk about gene therapy right now. What can we do genetically?
Well, not very much at present. And usually I'm not the conservative one in these circles, but I think today I'm going to have to be.
All right.
In that I think that while many of the possibilities are certainly going to emerge that have been discussed today, it's not a question of if these things are going to be possible, but sort of when and where and how they're going to be. But I think that the timescales are a little bit off, in that these are things that are certainly not going to have enormous impacts in the next decade or even two, probably.
You don't think so?
No, it takes a long time to move out of laboratory sort of proof of concept sorts of demonstrations and into the general population. When you look at, and most of these have not even had proof of principle demonstrated on them, just as the discussion of the nanobots that are going to sort of go through, that Joel was mentioning, that are going to sort of clean out your arteries and such. Well, that's a great concept, but actually to make that practical, to test it, to even bring something like that so that it could be tested is, you know, an enormous challenge. And it's a very far removed from the kinds of advanced materials that are being developed, which are, in existence today. And so there are lots and lots of things happening, but there tends to be a little bit of exuberance, just as with the Human Genome Project. That was going to be earth-shattering, and it will be in the long run, but it's been, you know, 4 years now since the sequencing of the human genome, and I don't think the earth has shifted beneath our feet.
To slightly play devil's advocate, when I read quotes from the former technology chief of Microsoft, so, you know, we'll give him some due credit there, he points out that it cost $12 billion to sequence that first human genome you're talking about, and the way he puts it is, you'll soon be able to basically walk into any sort of doctor's office, even maybe a storefront, and get your whole genome done for $10.
I think that's an exaggeration. That I would guess that within 5 to 10 years, you would be able to do it for $1,000. To get down to $10, but $1,000 is cheap enough. The challenge, though, is to understand that information. There have to be lots of broad population studies that are done. There have to be, I mean, the fact is that right now, while we're aware of lots of genes that have significant impacts on our health, especially that are responsible for various genetic diseases,
yes,
the constellations of genes that lead to aspects aspects of our personality, of our temperament, of who we are that are very important to us, things like intelligence, things like various types of athleticism and such. Those are more complex constellations of genes, and we certainly couldn't go in and manipulate those at present or even think about it. We can't even use genetic testing to say very much about those conditions. Now, I think these sorts of things will begin to occur, but it's going to be with genetic screening, for example, that'll be a good 10 to 15 years off before those will really have impacts.
But still, don't you think it's worth discussing, even on a philosophical level, because, you know, let's just say that currently we are still identifying, genes and connecting them with particular diseases and disorders for hopefully for the health of the human population. But the temptation to improve talents and even cosmetics and the people who have money being able to do so, it's worth looking ahead to that already.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting stuff to talk about. It's fun stuff to talk about. But, for example, the discussion of warfare and the super sort of soldier of the future. Actually, if you look at the larger sort of landscape of what's going on, the tendency is to move away from having individuals in harm's way, in combat. I think that the movement is towards, for instance, pilotless airplanes and such. And so a lot of these impacts, these are things that are going to be important developments, and it's not, and DARPA is looking at some really cutting-edge, interesting stuff. But I think that the real reshaping of warfare is going to be in using drones and removing humans from the battlefield. So you have to look at the much larger context, and I think that sports, there's going to be a constant sort of battle in terms of those who want to enhance and those who are trying to detect enhancement, and the lines become very blurred and very arbitrary in many ways. But once again, I don't think you're going to have these superhuman athletes that are going to be in the very immediate future. It's the most significant applications are going to occur with fixing diminutions, with allowing someone who is paralyzed to control their legs, to do these sorts of things, rather than to enhance average performers or superior performers. Those, and not because I think there's something wrong with enhancement, that's what we want, but the risk-reward profile is going to take much longer to be compelling for individuals.
Yeah, interesting. All I know is that when you compare the growth of the human being on this planet from the 1930s to today, there's a certain profile, average. And then when you look at the athlete, when you look at Jesse Owens and take Michael Johnson next to him, and the athlete's generations have grown exponentially more than the society at large. And so, you know, it makes us think with all that technology and all those resources that those athletes have had at the upper echelons, well, you know, what will happen when they get a hold of that next? I want to go back to Michael Goldblatt, who's a former director of the Defense Sciences Offices at the Defense Advanced Research Project. That's DARPA. Mr. Goldblatt, you've been listening to Dr. Stock talk for a few minutes there. Do you have any particular reactions, particularly when it comes to gene therapy?
Well, gene therapy, Dr. Stock's absolutely right. Gene therapy is probably something that is going to be in the laboratory for a while. There are lots of questions which concern it, but those research experiments will go on. But it's also true that there is low-hanging fruit which is coming out of some of these opportunities. Not all of them enhance the human directly. Some of them do it peripherally. For instance, Dr. Stock is absolutely right. The battlefield of today and tomorrow is a very lethal place, and the human being is the weakest link in that chain. And so if you can't remove them, enhancing survivability is absolutely critical. And one of the things that happens in those kinds of environments is that you can, you know, when you have profuse bleeding in the battlefield, it's getting the fluids to retain in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have natural clotting factors, which have become deficient, how do you keep the fluid in? Well, platelets, that natural clotting factor, have a very short shelf life, 5 days refrigerated, 4 to 5 days refrigerated, and it's impractical to use platelets in the battlefield. However, you know, one of the things that comes out of examining what Mother Nature has done in terms of extremophiles is that you can now take those platelets and you can create shelf-stable platelets where you just add water and then you can infuse, and you can have those products stable now for years at room temperature or at higher temperatures, and then when you need them, just add water and infuse. The problem is, as has been rightly pointed out, is that it creates a tremendous shift in the infrastructure and paradigms that exist. Hence, while the technology exists, getting it deployed requires a lot of, hard work at a basic level in terms of acceptance of technology and deployment of it. And if that's the kind of thing you have for a relatively low-hanging fruit, getting to these higher opportunities is going to be more difficult.
Yeah, an uphill battle. You know,
yeah.
And I suppose, you know, both you and Dr. Stock are pointing the picture, at least with war. We've kind of come to the end, haven't we? This will be the last generation that we combat, you know, right ground to ground. We're not going to be able to do that much longer.
Well, there's another kind of war that's also going on, and that's Mother Nature's war in terms of infectious disease. And in some ways, some people would say that Mother Nature is an awesome terrorist in and of herself in terms of the ability to create new pathogens which exist, and that those pathogens have an uncanny adaptability in terms of the defenses that we have, both to the host's immune defense and to drugs that come out, because resistance becomes a very big issue as we have development of antibiotic resistance and new organisms which continue to emerge, which we haven't seen before, whether it's SARS or the Nipah virus or Hantavirus.
Yes.
And so that opens up the whole idea of changing the paradigm of infectious disease, of going beyond attacking the pathogen as a measure towards saving the host to targeting the host to halt the process of disease. Because in that case, the host, if you take a virus, for instance, let's take HIV, the host is absolutely essential to the life cycle of the virus. The human plays an essential role in that. And if you can identify and block those parts of the human's anatomy which are essential to the pathogen but not the human, not only do you halt the progression of disease, but the development of drug resistance becomes much more problematic for the pathogen, because they have to now replace an entire host mechanism, a part of their life cycle, not just the single point genetic mutation, which is why it's so difficult to get a permanent vaccine, say, for influenza or HIV.
Sure, sure. That makes sense. Dr. Gregory Stock, if you'd come back with us.
Yeah.
I want to ask you something, because we're just about at the tail end, and I wanted you to have last word on the thirst for the fountain of youth. We've talked today about health and about war and about, you know, ways to use these enhancements. But what about prolonging life, gerontology?
Well, I think that's the key application, because it's easy to talk about transforming ourselves into forklifts or a lot of enhancements that we really can be obtained in other ways by interfacing with computers and such. But when it comes right down to it, it's our health that we care about. It's, you know, the degenerative process in humans is one that's very, very difficult and a brutal one. And the fact is, we are understanding the workings of our biology at a very deep level, and we're beginning to get in there and tinker and analyze it and look at it. And this is a fundamental breakthrough in the history of life. And the big application or a big focus will be, can we extend the human lifespan in some way? If we're able to do that and we're able to control the aging process, and there are many biogerontologists who not only believe that it's possible, but think that that might happen within the next generation or two, that we would begin to make inroads into that.
And then everybody, I know that our listeners are going to want me to ask you, and this, I'm afraid this will be the last question for today, Dr. Stock. Great, we can extend the lifespan, but then, you know, if we live to be 150 and 170 and someday 300 years, what about aging? It's okay to live longer.
I meant entirely to extend human vitality. Nobody is interested in extending our decrepitude.
Okay.
So if you could slow down the rate of aging, though, so that you would extend the vital human lifespan, then it's obvious that we want that. Otherwise, why would we pay so much for vitamins and for cosmetic surgery and all of the things that just give a little bit of the appearance of youth and don't really work very well? Why would people risk their lives using human growth hormone and such? So that is the big question. Can that occur? And if so, in how much time? And I think I'm 55. I think I'll be very, very lucky if there's a substantial life extension that occurs in my lifespan, but I would love to see it. And I think that my daughter, who's, you know, I have a 2-year-old daughter, she is very likely to have that arrive in her lifetime.
Well,
so that's kind of the range. And the way we fund these things, the attitudes that we have about them, will have big impacts on whether we're going to be sort of among the last generations to live a normal human lifespan or among the first to probably live, have experience of extended vitality and reduced diseases in a variety of ways. So time matters. But in the big picture, it's extraordinary. It's mind-boggling to imagine where humanity will be in a matter of a few centuries.
It is, and I'm sure you would feel the same way in all of our guests today. I wish I could be around in a few centuries to see, you know, just as what going to, how we are going to evolve. Dr. Gregory Stock, thank you so much for all your time today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And I thank our other guests, Michael Goldblatt, Dr. Harry Whelan, and Joel Garreau. On Reporter's Notebook, in just a minute, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist does an about-face on stem cell research. We'll be right back with more of To the Point from PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Diana Nyad, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Whether or not to expand funding for stem cell research is one of Washington's touchiest subjects, and today it got even touchier. After passing through the House, the stem cell bill has been stalled in the Senate, with Senate Republican leader Bill Frist echoing President Bush's stand to oppose it. But this morning, Mr. Frist announced he has decided to reverse his position and back expansion of stem cell research, a move that will no doubt push the bill closer to passage and possibly prompt President Bush to use the first veto of his office. Joining us now is Mike Madden, who's a correspondent with Gannett News Service and the Tennessean's Washington Bureau. Mr. Madden, how are you?
I'm good, Diana. How are you?
Well, good. Let's talk about this because, you know, it's been reported, and I just said myself, well, he switched his position. But if we go back a few years ago, actually his current position of today is consistent with what he used to think, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's something that Frist's office has been careful to remind people of today as well. He initially supported in 2001 a slightly more expansive policy than the one that the president came out with later that summer. And he had said all along he intended to keep on top of the science and possibly review things as they needed reviewing. And I think the root of his decision today was the fact that many of the stem lines that the president had announced would be eligible for federal funding simply aren't panning out to be worthwhile for research. Only 22 are still viable, and a lot of those are apparently contaminated as well.
And that's 22 out of what, an original 78?
78,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it is fading. I understand that Mr. Frist has, Dr. Frist, I should say, has supported bills for adult stem cell research, you know, other types of options. Did he run out of hope on those?
No, I mean, he actually said this morning that he still intends to seek legislation to increase funding for adult stem cell research on a similar track with this bill, and he also has supported research into cord blood stem cells, which are another possible source of things, and additionally some possible new techniques to develop pluripotential stem cells, which are cells that can, like embryonic stem cells, evolve into any type of cell without having to destroy an embryo. But in the end, the promise of embryonic stem cell research is fairly high, and Frist said, he could no longer ignore the potential there, and as long as the ethical frameworks are set up in a way that he's comfortable with, he's going to support this bill.
And the ethics, I guess, because, you know, just on the surface, you would think that it's pretty difficult to be both pro-life, which Dr. Frist is, and pro-embryonic stem cell funding. But when he says we need to be careful, we need to be thoughtful, he's talking about frozen embryos that would be discarded anyway.
That's right.
Is that the issue?
Yeah. It's embryos that were created for fertility treatments are no longer being used, would otherwise be discarded, and are donated with, you know, express consent of the people that had created them in the first place. Frist is also seeking some provisions in the legislation that would make clear that there can't be any financial incentives involved either, so
right.
Prevent the possibility of anyone selling embryos for research.
Do we assume that with Dr. Frist being a surgeon himself, that he's more than a leader in this particular area in the Senate? Now that he's declared his position, will it go through pretty quickly come September?
Well, supporters of this research had been saying all along that if he would schedule a vote on it, they had the votes to pass it. There's fairly strong support in the Senate for the bill that passed the House. Frist had been delaying scheduling a vote in part because he was still reviewing the issue and trying to decide exactly what his personal position on it was going to be, but also there were some attempts to work out compromises and alternative bills, and there was an idea of maybe bringing them all to the floor at the same time, and they sort of ran out of time on that before the fall. So now that he's signed on to this, you know, it'll likely come up, although it's still a little bit unclear when, and certainly supporters would expect it to pass. The question is whether they'll have enough votes to override a veto if the president chooses to use that.
Yes, and last thing, if you would, Mr. Madden, what about Dr. Frist's potential political, you know, aspirations beyond the Senate nomination for 2008 presidential party? Has he put his concerns of patients today over politics?
Well, it may seem that way. This has not been greeted very favorably by some of the religious conservative organizations that had for most of this year been very pleased with Frist, especially because of his work on nominating conservative judges. But it remains to be seen, I guess, whether they'll forgive him for this or not.
Thank you so much, Mike Madden.
Thank you.
Correspondent with Gannett News Service. The producers of To the Point are Christian Bordahl, Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, Sharon Rembaum, and Andrea Brody. The managing producer is Karen Radziner. Special thanks to Jennifer Sohn and Charisse Williams. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. The technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Diana Nyad. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.